Let me shift us to what's happening in the markets this Friday morning, because the dollar's position heading into the close is telling a specific story that's worth unpacking. S&P futures are at 7,687.5, up about 25 points or 0.33% from the prior session. That's not dramatic movement, but it's directionally positive. The dollar story is more complicated.
Walk me through what you're seeing there, Marcus, because the Reuters framing, investors balk at US Treasury's rescue efforts, is doing a lot of work in a few words.
Right. The dollar is on track for a weekly loss as of Friday's reporting. The phrase rescue efforts from the Treasury suggests there have been active interventions or policy signals aimed at supporting dollar strength, and the market's response has been skeptical. When investors balk at rescue efforts, what that typically means is that the underlying conditions driving dollar weakness are perceived as more structural than whatever short-term intervention is being offered. The dollar's role as the world's reserve currency gives the Treasury significant tools to manage exchange rate conditions, open market operations, verbal interventions, coordination with allies through forums like the G7. But these tools work best when markets believe the fundamentals are aligned. If there are genuine concerns about U.S. fiscal trajectory, about the credibility of monetary policy, or about geopolitical factors affecting dollar demand, then Treasury actions get treated as noise rather than signal.
And the overnight S&P futures data shows that pattern. The contract traded in a very tight range all night, between roughly 7,664 and 7,671, for most of the session, before jumping to 7,687 inches the morning. That tight overnight band followed by a morning pop is typical of thin pre-weekend trading, where institutional investors have largely positioned themselves. And the movement is driven by retail flows and algorithmic adjustments rather than genuine conviction.
Which means we should be careful about reading too much directional signal into the 0.33% gain. A market that's genuinely confident moves with more conviction and volume than we typically see in overnight futures. The more important question for next week is whether the dollar's weekly loss triggers any portfolio rebalancing that could affect equity correlations, because a weaker dollar isn't automatically bad for U.S. equities. In fact, for multinationals, it can be a revenue tailwind, but it does signal something about global confidence in U.S. policy direction.
There's also a currency dimension to the UN race we've been discussing. Greenspan's UNCTAD background means she's thought deeply about the dollar's structural advantages in global trade finance and the ways those advantages create burdens for developing economies. Whoever leads the UN in 2027 will be operating in a global economic environment where dollar hegemony is being actively questioned, not just by Russia and China, but by a broader coalition of emerging market economies seeking alternatives in settlement and reserves.
That's a real through line. The institutional reform debates happening at the UN and the currency dynamics playing out in forex markets are both expressions of the same underlying tension. A post-1945 international architecture designed around American primacy that is being stress-tested by a multipolar reality. The dollar's wobble on any given Friday is just one data point, but it sits in that larger context. Now, before we go deeper on the economic picture, I want to bring in our curriculum corner, because understanding antitrust law will actually help make sense of some of the tech and competition policy stories we'll touch on later, and it's a concept that gets referenced constantly but rarely explained with any precision. The core of U.S. antitrust law starts with the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, which is remarkably old for legislation that still shapes trillion-dollar industries. The Sherman Act has two main provisions. Section 1 prohibits agreements that restrain trade, think price fixing or market allocation between competitors, and Section 2 prohibits monopolization, meaning the act of acquiring or maintaining monopoly power through exclusionary conduct. Here's what most people get wrong. Simply having a large market share is not illegal under U.S. antitrust law. If a company becomes dominant because it genuinely builds better products, operates more efficiently, and wins customers fair and square, that's competition working as intended. The law doesn't punish success. What it does prohibit is using monopoly power, typically defined by courts as something above 70% market share, though there's no fixed threshold, combined with anti-competitive conduct to harm competition. Think of it like a foot race. If one runner is just faster than everyone else, that's fine. But if that runner starts tripping competitors or cutting across the track to block others, that's where the law intervenes. The key phrase in the Sherman Act is willful acquisition or maintenance of monopoly power through means other than superior skill or product. Proving that combination, market power plus exclusionary conduct, is why antitrust cases are so resource-intensive and take so long to litigate.
And this matters for tech specifically, because the platforms that dominate today have market shares that would trigger serious scrutiny on the market power prong. But the conduct analysis is genuinely harder to establish. The legal question isn't, is Google very large? It's, did Google use its size to specifically harm competition through conduct that wouldn't make business sense absent the goal of excluding rivals? That's a harder case to make, which is why these trials stretch over years.
Exactly. Keep that framework in mind whenever you read about tech antitrust. The question isn't size, it's the combination of size and specific exclusionary behavior.